It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we talk about the economic impact of trying 17-year-olds as adults.
But first, environmental groups in northeast Wisconsin are calling on the federal government to address water contamination issues in Kewaunee County.
Reports from last December showed that about a third of the wells that were tested in that county were found to have unsafe drinking water. Yesterday, representatives from six different environmental interest groups signed on to a letter to the EPA. They want that federal agency to take a greater role in addressing water contamination issues.
The letter follows an earlier request for EPA investigation into contaminated groundwater in that region. That request for a federal investigation prompted involvement by the state's Department of Natural Resources, but critics say that the progress has been slow.
Here to tell us more is Lee Bergquist. He's a reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He covers environmental issues and politics. Lee, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob.
Well, before we dig into the problems people have been talking about in Kewaunee County, what exactly are these environmental groups wanting the EPA to do in this new letter?
Well, they would like, in an immediate way, to ensure that these folks have access to clean drinking water. If it's proven that the contaminated wells are due to contamination from manure, something like that, there is a language under the Clean Water Drinking Act that would allow, call for a government agency like the DNR or the EPA to provide water for them. That's the immediate issue. The longer issue is they just feel that the EPA needs to provide more oversight over the DNR on this issue.
Well, talk about the problems we're seeing with water in Kewaunee County. What are people reporting when they test wells up there?
Well, there was a study, and it's interesting. The environmentalists are criticizing the DNR, but they're also pointing to a study that was funded by the DNR. So, and the work was done by the U.S. Agriculture Research Service and UW Oshkosh, and they found, as your report preceding this said, that about 34% of 320 wells that were tested failed to meet drinking water standards. This was for nitrates and total coliform. Now, manure can be a source for those two pollutants, but it can be other sources. It could come from other things as well. The key would be something like E. coli. Then you know then it's probably coming from fecal contamination. And in that case, there's only been so far maybe a handful of wells that have tested positive in that regard.
So, yeah, when you say coliform contamination, you're talking about a group of bacteria that includes but is not limited to E. coli. Is that right?
Yes. Thank you very much for clarifying that. Yes.
So this seems like it's the controversy. Is this contamination coming from agricultural runoff, from mainly dairy farms? And there
right.
are a lot of cows, I think more cows than people in this area we're talking about. Is that right?
There's clearly more cows than people. I think in past stories I've indicated that the cattle in Kewaunee County produce more manure than all the humans in Milwaukee. And of course, in this case, much of that manure then is spread on land in Kewaunee County, and as I understand it, also in some adjoining counties as well. The problem in Kewaunee County is that there are parts of the county where the soils are very thin. Beneath it, the bedrock is called karst. It's fractured so that under right circumstances, if the manure is spread improperly or too heavily, and there's rain, then this manure can wash right into the groundwater and potentially harm people's drinking water.
Talking to Lee Bergquist from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about groundwater contamination in northeastern Wisconsin, especially Kewaunee County. A group of environmental organizations just wrote a letter to the Environmental Protection Agency asking them to step in, take more direct control over this issue. And the idea there, I guess, Lee, is that the DNR is supposed to be the agency in charge of this, and these environmental groups anyway are saying they're not doing enough. Is that right?
They're making the argument that the DNR is not doing enough. However, to be fair, the DNR for over a year has been holding a series of work groups, which included a representative of the EPA on it, and they are not yet completed with all of the work of these work groups. And they say they really haven't had enough time to digest all of what has come out of these groups that would come up with recommendations for changes, and so they say that the charges of inaction by the DNR at the very minimum is premature at this time because they still got a lot of work to do.
And we've heard from a representative of dairy farming groups in that region who say, hey, we're managing this well. You can't really point the blame for this water contamination at us. What are we hearing from farmers and dairy farmers in that area?
Well, that's what the finger of blame goes primarily to these very, very large dairy farms with thousands of cattle on each farm. And their argument is that they're called CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations. Those kinds of farms are more heavily regulated than a small farm. They're on how much manure they can spread on their property. There should be no discharge whatsoever from their operations into waterways. The critics of CAFOs say, well, that's true, that's what the laws say, but in practice, there's just too many farms for the landscape in question.
Now, the environmental groups who are calling on the EPA to take action, are they looking for something that changes the way these farms, these CAFOs operate, from closing them down to different kinds of regulation, different kinds of practices?
Well, I think they would like to see more staff by the DNR overseeing the operations of these farms. At one time, there was some, this goes all the way back to the Doyle administration, there was a bill that was being advanced that would limit certain areas where manure could be spread because of the sensitive nature of the soils. That went nowhere, even under a Democratic administration, and I'm sure that at some point something like that will come up again, and it'll be difficult with a Republican administration right now.
Have we heard anything from the EPA? I know it's just a day old, but about this new request?
Nah, they. I've talked to them yesterday and again today, and they just basically are saying we have to look at all this. They're not providing comment at this point.
For people in the area, is this something? There have been these well tests, but is this something that people in Kewaunee County are noticing, are worried about? Are they drinking different water or filtering this water in a special way?
Well, I think people are having their wells tested more often. There was this kiosk that provided water in Algoma, which is in the county, at the high school. That's been vandalized three times now. Kind of a sign that of the divisiveness of this issue in the county. But people are having their waters tested. I think they're trying to be more careful about it. But these are only, so far, again, this one-third of the wells, those are the wells that have been tested. Not every well in Kewaunee County has this problem. It seems to be in certain pockets of the county where this problem seems to be most severe.
And, Lee, do you think we're going to see any kind of resolution of this story anytime soon?
No, I don't.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again, Lee.
Okay, thanks a lot. Happy to do it.
That's Lee Bergquist, reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about a new request from environmental groups for the EPA to intervene and try to protect drinking water in Kewaunee County.
Coming up, our guest makes an economic case for keeping 17-year-olds out of adult court. But first, Peter Bryan joins us from the newsroom with a look at headlines.
A recent report makes an economic argument for keeping 17-year-olds out of adult courts here in Wisconsin.
A spate of tough-on-crime laws from the 1990s resulted in changes to Wisconsin law, and today 17-year-olds are tried as adults in Wisconsin, which can be a costly process for the offender and for taxpayers.
The report looks at factors including a person's likelihood to recommit a crime, the growth of criminal justice spending, and other costs of putting juveniles in adult court.
Joining us now to talk about that report is one of its authors, Ola Lisowski. She's a research associate for the John K. MacIver Institute for Public Policy. Ola, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, when people advocate to move 17-year-olds into juvenile court, they usually say that the process of putting them in adult courts is unfair and that maybe it opens them up to risk and assault. But you're making the case here, this report is making the case, that's an economic one for trying 17-year-olds in juvenile court. Why?
When we look at trying nonviolent 17-year-olds as adults compared to trying them as juveniles, it does turn out to be much more expensive, and that's when we look at recidivism. So, in other words, when a nonviolent 17-year-old leaves prison, what's the likeliness that he or she will end up back in prison? In Wisconsin, according to the Legislative Audit Bureau, we know that a 17-year-old tried in the adult system is actually three times more likely to end up back in the system compared to somebody who started off in the juvenile system. So we have to ask ourselves, with numbers like these, what are we doing wrong? And are there any alternatives that are not only more cost-effective, but actually produce better results for our youth and our communities?
And according to these findings, do we know just how much Wisconsin could save by putting more 17-year-olds, nonviolent 17-year-olds, in the juvenile court system?
So that's actually a bit of a point of contention right now. So the counties have estimated that it would take several millions of dollars. Other groups, such as the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families, say that the counties are actually overestimating that price tag by a lot, and that it would only cost a couple million dollars up front. So that's not something that we have a hard and fast number for, but by looking at the experience of other states, we do know unequivocally that moving younger offenders, even just the nonviolent ones, would save the state money in the end. We saw this pretty close to home in Minnesota, where youths tried as adults were 16% more likely to reoffend than those tried in the juvenile system. And the same is true in Illinois, which raised the age of juvenile court jurisdiction to 18 back in 2009. They had that same argument down there, which was, will this cause our crime rates to go up and for public safety to go down? A couple years later, we know that those things did not happen and that the state actually was able to close up three juvenile facilities because of low occupancy. Texas is another state, a more conservative state, that was looking at making this change. The National Conservative Movement for Criminal Justice Reform is basically headed up out of Texas with Right on Crime and the Texas Public Policy Foundation, which, of course, co-authored our report. There in Texas, researchers at UT Austin found that raising the age of juvenile jurisdiction to 17 would have a net benefit of almost $89 million for each cohort of 17-year-olds. So this is a lot of money. It would turn out to be a lot in the end that we would save, even though it would be a bit more upfront.
So looking strictly at the laws on the books surrounding this in Wisconsin, how does Wisconsin compare with the laws that other states have?
Well, so Wisconsin right now is right now there are 41 states, as well as Washington, D.C., that hold the upper boundary of the juvenile court's jurisdiction at 17. Wisconsin is one of seven states that draw the boundary at 16, and there are actually two states that have it at 15. So we are one of the few left that are still automatically charging our 17-year-olds as adults.
And as I understand it, Wisconsin also has the once-waived, always-waived provision for youth 14 years and older. How does that work?
So that kind of depends on the scenario. In very, very serious circumstances, such as the Slenderman case from a couple years ago, youth that young can be automatically can be transferred into the adult system, depending on the type of crime. So what we're asking in this report, you know, we're really just kind of looking at the older age of the spectrum, those nonviolent first-time 17-year-old offenders, and saying, look, in this area, is there something that we can do better? And looking at the experience of other states, you know, we think that we can.
Well, to look at where laws like this came from, can you put that into a little bit of historical context about when these laws first appeared on Wisconsin books?
Sure. So back in the mid-90s, 1995, we saw a wave of crime across the country. And so that spurred this kind of tough-on-crime movement where the thinking was, let's raise penalties to deter criminals, increase mandatory minimum sentences, and go after 17-year-olds who should know better, and the crime rate will go down. So in some ways, that ended up being true, but since the mid-90s, crime rates have fallen not only in Wisconsin, but actually across the country. So right now, we're in a situation where we see these big government programs where the number of juveniles arrested has fallen by more than half, but at the same time, we're spending more money to house them. What we've seen, if you look at since 2009, if you look at per juvenile arrest, the counties get almost 50% more funding per juvenile getting arrested. So we have to ask ourselves, is this the best idea out there, and are we doing this as effectively as we can?
We're talking with Ola Laskowski right now from the John K. MacIver Institute for Public Policy, talking about the possible economic benefits of keeping 17-year-old offenders out of adult courts. And one thing that critics of this idea have said before is that, you know, the people in question here may not be getting the right punishment, that the system might end up going easy on them. What do you say to that?
You know, it depends on who you talk to. So I bring up this point in my report, but in the juvenile system, parents and schools play a much more significant role, whereas in the adult system, they don't even require that parents are notified if their 17-year-old is arrested. So rather than thinking about this as, are we being tough enough or are we spending enough money, we need to ask, are we being effective with our tax dollars? You know, from our perspective as defenders of the free market, we've really got to work hard to scrutinize public dollars that are spent. And we have to ask that question, are we doing the best job that we can, given the money that we have to spend? And, you know, I think you'll see if you look at other states and their experiences, we can do better and get better results, not only for our youth and for our communities, but for our taxpayers as well. So that's why I'm a big fan of the name Right on Crime. You know, it's kind of taking over the tough on crime language and saying, no, it's not about being tough or about spending the most money. It's about being right and correct and doing it the right way.
So looking at why those who go through the adult system, 17-year-olds who go through the adult system are more likely to reoffend, what do we know about how the juvenile system works and the resources there that might be keeping people from reoffending?
In the juvenile system, it really just works a bit differently. There are a lot more what they call wraparound services. Like I said, they involve the parents more. There are more restrictions there, more counseling, et cetera. You know, you have these troubled youths. They're committing crimes starting at a young age. And you have to think about if you're putting them in a bad situation with adult offenders, I mean, what's going to happen there? You know, what kind of people are they surrounded by? Are those people good influences? And then there's also the huge question of the safety of these 17-year-olds. You know, there are some, I focus on the economic argument in my report, but we do have some safety numbers in there where, you know, one study found youths are 36 times more likely to commit suicide in an adult jail than a juvenile facility. So, you know, you really just have to look at those numbers and you have to ask, is there a better way to do this?
Now, this is a growing field, the science data here, but your report also looks into the development of adolescent brains. And what did you find there and how that might factor into this discussion?
Yeah, so what we do know there, basically since the 90s, we have had quite a bit more neurobiological research that has furthered our understanding of juvenile brains. And actually, the development of magnetic resonance imaging, that has allowed researchers to view images of the brain throughout different stages of development. So now, since this, since these changes were made, we know a lot more about the prefrontal cortex, the area of the brain that controls impulsive behavior and rational thought. We know now that that's not fully developed until people are in their early 20s. Why is that significant from a policy standpoint? Well, you know, the Supreme Court actually answered that question in 2005. When they ruled it to be unconstitutional to use the death penalty on an offender under the age of 18, saying that they actually relied upon the neurobiological research there and cited it in their decision.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
That was Ola Lasowski, a research associate at the John K. McIver Institute for Public Policy. She joined us to talk about the economic benefits of trying 17-year-olds as juveniles rather than adults. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. When it comes to taking risks, it seems like not all of us are created equal. Some of us will jump at the chance to pick up and move across the country or jump out of an airplane, while others seem to shy away from risk, preferring the comfort and stability that a daily routine can provide. That's me. But why is that?
Well, our next guest has studied the science that goes into risk-taking and the factors that go into whether or not we're likely to pump the gas pedal or the brakes when it comes to risk. In addition, she says that by better understanding risk, we can learn to be better and smarter risk-takers, leading to both professional and personal success in our everyday lives.
Kate Sukel joins us now. She's a science writer and author of the new book, The Art of Risk, The New Science of Courage, Caution, and Chance. Kate, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited about it.
Kate, let's talk about what risk is. You write that a lot of us, when we think risk, we go to the extremes, kind of like a heroic risk of a soldier at war, maybe, or a foolish risk of, I don't know, jumping into a pool full of sharks or something. You say risk is actually something in our everyday lives. So how do we define it?
So simply put, you know, risk is just dealing with uncertainty. It's making a decision where you have a potentially negative outcome. And so when you break it down to something that simple, all of a sudden, you know, every single decision you make every single day, that's whether to have that third cup of coffee in the morning, you know, that might wake you up at, you know, 2 in the morning wanting to, like, pace your bedroom walls, or that's whether you're about to move across the country, take a new job, or jump in that pool with sharks. Who, by the way, don't really like to eat humans, so you'd probably be okay.
Yay. Well, and you say when we're looking at an important decision, and one that you were going through as you wrote the book, whether or not to get married, it's really a matter of risk assessment.
That is true. I had gone through a pretty painful divorce a few years earlier, and this man asked me to marry him, and he seemed like a good bet, but how was I supposed to know? But really, again, it comes down to that assessment. There's uncertainty. How comfortable are you? How can you think through the equation? What factors are really important? And luckily, you know, I had learned enough from my first marriage and learned enough from my new partner that it sort of helped me figure out whether or not I should take the leap and jump that broom or go home and keep watching The Bachelor.
Well, and another kind of misconception your book cleared up for me, I always think there's just a continuum. On one end are the me's out there who avoid risk whenever possible. The other end are the really impulsive risk takers. But you kind of introduced a new category, smart risk takers. So it's possible to calibrate ourselves to know when and how to take a risk.
Definitely. And this sort of goes back to these extremes, because I think that we have to be very careful when we talk about risk taking. And in fact, when you talk to psychologists and epidemiologists these days, they're actually being more careful, because there's risk taking and then there's impulsive behavior. Mm-hmm. And certainly historically, you know, scientists have looked at negative risk taking behaviors, the things that are going to land you in jail, the things that are going to, you know, get you dead or injured or hurt other people. And obviously, those aren't the risks that we want to take. Those aren't the things that are going to help us do better in life and achieve our dreams. Nobody really accomplished much from the inside of a jail cell or, you know, from underground. But there is a way to approach risk to make it work for you, especially, again, since every single decision, has that element of uncertainty. Once you become more comfortable with it, once you become more knowledgeable about how the brain actually deals with this uncertainty, and it is sort of more of an art than a science, hence the book title, you really can make it work for you.
And a big lesson you draw from people who we think of as risk-taking, the person who climbs that mountain without the backup oxygen supply, or the deep-sea diver, or the bold investor, they actually, what looks to us as a risky thing, the people who are doing it and doing it well take as much of the risk out of it as they can in a lot of ways.
It was so interesting to me. I talked to a number of risk takers for this book, including Steph Davis, who is a base jumper and free solo climber. You may know her as the only woman that Cliff Bar dropped from their sponsorship ranks because they decided that she's too risky. I talked to Andy Frankenberger, who's a World Series of Poker champion. I talked to a neurosurgeon, a firefighter, a special forces operator. And time and time again, they would all tell me, I really don't think of myself as a risk taker. I don't think that what I do is all that risky. And you'd kind of push them on it and be like, you jump off cliffs, you rappel from helicopters into enemy combat situations. And they really talked about how they really prepare for these different things. People only see the outcome. They don't see all the work that goes into, these big payouts. And really, it's the little things that they do every day that help them, handle those big decisions, those big ticket choices when they meet up with them in life. And that was fascinating to me because that means that it's not that Steph Davis is wired differently than me or she's just somebody who can, handle this stuff and I can't. What that means is that we all have this ability. It's just a matter of thinking about risk in a different way.
Talking to Kate Sukul about her new book, The Art of Risk, The New Science of Courage, Caution, and Chance. And Kate, I want to follow up that last point you made. The person who looks like a risk taker isn't necessarily hardwired. And that's another thing I'd kind of thought, like, hey, some people are born to do that wild stuff. Some people are not. But it's more complicated than that.
It is. I mean, certainly some people are more wired for sensation. They need a little bit more stress in their life. They find joy in things like, jumping out of airplanes or whitewater rafting or what have you. But a lot of times that's not necessarily just biology. That's also sort of opportunity and environment. You can think of something like taking the subway. Now, I went to school in New York City. I love the subway. It works for me. It's so easy to use. But I have friends who aren't familiar with it. They go to New York City, and they freak out about it. They're convinced they're going to be mugged. They're going to die on the train. They're going to get lost. And they get really, really upset about it. But then you take that New Yorker who knows the subway inside and out, and you take them, maybe to some back roads in Door County or what have you, and they may be like, wait a minute, this road isn't marked. I have no idea where I'm going. My GPS isn't working. What's going on? So a lot of it really is kind of familiarity and opportunity. And so even as we say, oh, this person must be so different, they just had a different, background. They have a different preparation. And so they found this domain, whether it be base jumping or race car driving or what have you, where they can sort of find that kick for novelty and for excitement and a certain stress level that motivates them.
And you share some lessons about dealing with risk and being smart risk takers. And that's one of them is to, before you make that big leap, do some homework, get familiar with the context in which you're taking that risk, and then you're going to make smarter decisions, more measured decisions.
Correct. And, what's so fascinating to me, again, is that so much of the work shows that whether or not you think something is risky, whether you perceive a situation as risky, really depends on how familiar you are with it. I remember talking to my great-grandmother about snowboarding. Now, she just thought that this was the most ridiculous thing ever. Why would you go snowboarding? You're going to hurt yourself. It just looks silly. You're just asking, to crash your head in or what have you. But she's not familiar with it. She doesn't know about it. But now, that same great-grandma, was happy to drive around in all those cars that, had those sharp tail fins that would take an arm off in an accident. Didn't think twice about it. So it really, how we perceive risk has a lot to do with where we came from, what we're familiar with, what our friends are doing, and it really can shape the risk equation in interesting ways.
But there can be a downside of that if our circle of friends is doing some kind of negative, dangerous behavior, high risk, no reward, heroin use or something like that. That can change our mental perception of that risk and make it feel to us less risky.
That is true, and that is something to think about when you are thinking about more negative risks. Now, but these are things that we also hear a lot about, right? We know that narcotic use probably isn't going to be in our favor, and so we certainly public outreach programs are helpful in that regard. I think the real difference, though, is when we're talking about negative versus a positive risk, and certainly our social circles are going to influence what we're familiar with and what we feel comfortable with. Is that, you know, that comes into doing homework. Are we relying too much on those social circles? Are they giving us information that may be incorrect or isn't helping us out? And again, that's where, you know, sometimes it helps to take a step back, take a moment, and ask yourself, wait a minute, is this actually leading me where I want to be? Is this going to help me achieve my long-term goals?
One thing that struck me is the role of stress in measuring risk. You say no stress actually doesn't help. Too much stress is bad, but there's a Goldilocks just right spot for stress when we're making that decision.
Absolutely. You know, we've really turned stress into a dirty word, right? It's supposed to be mitigated, avoided at all costs. It's a bad, bad thing. And if we're not going to yoga every week or meditating or, you know, going to happy hour, we have a problem. But what we don't seem to realize is that stress, it's a biological process that's there for a reason, and it's there to motivate us. Certainly when we talk about extremes, it's there to motivate us to, you know, fight or fly. But in the medium, you know, think about just something as simple as a final exam. If you don't have a little bit of stress about it, you're probably not going to study and do well. If you're not a little bit stressed about, you know, working on that business deal, you're not going to put in the time to make sure that it's done just right. So you really do want that stress happy medium. The trick, however, is that it varies substantially from person to person. Some people, even, you know, a little bit of stress can sort of knock them out of whack. And then we have some people, and one of these people was the Army Special Forces operator that I spoke to. You know, nothing fazes him. I mean, you can freeze him, you can heat him up, you can shoot things at him, and he's still pretty stable. So there is a wide range of individual differences, and the trick is finding your own stress happy medium, just enough to get you up and motivated, to get you, you know, to work at the edge of your performance ability and improve your skill set and do better, but not so much that, you know, you're ready to cry or kill somebody or hide in your closet for the next week.
We're talking right now with Kate Sukel, author of the book, The Art of Risk. She says we all take risks all the time, whether we realize it or not. And by understanding risk a little bit better, we can make better, smarter choices.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you consider yourself to be a risk taker? What's the biggest risk that you ever took, and did it pay off? How do you weigh risk in your personal and your professional life? And what questions do you have about the brain science behind risk taking? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about risk, what it is, why some of us seem inclined toward risk-taking, and how we can make the most of it. Our guest is Kate Sukel, author of the new book called The Art of Risk.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about a time that you took a risk. What was it? How did it work out? Would you do it again? Lessons learned? How do you assess risk in your everyday life? The old positive and negative list? What do you do? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. Mark is on the line in Howard. Mark, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling in from Howard, Wisconsin here. And I wanted to chime in and say that my entire life, it's been risk has always been like the funnest thing to get to do. From an early age playing baseball, I wanted to play pitcher, started racing motocross, fly-powered paraglider. And I think it really comes down to that. The nervous, the adrenaline, the excitement becomes almost addicting. You look forward to the next time that you can get out, and you become kind of a risk management. You're always weighing the risk versus reward. But it almost is, it's a very powerful, adrenaline is almost like a powerful drug that you get addicted to.
Does that worry you a little, Mark?
No, I love it.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call. So, Kate, we get a little addicted to that adrenaline rush of taking a risk.
Well, and that's what we were saying about the certain amount of stress to motivate you. It releases these brain chemicals that really does get you going. Things like, you know, the adrenaline, it also releases dopamine, which is often called the pleasure chemical, although that's a bit oversimplified, which is also really rewarding and motivating force. So definitely when you're dealing with uncertainty and it works out for you, that is a huge deal. That is a huge boost, and it's a boost to learning. It's a helps you with risk management, like you said, and really does give you a rush. And certainly that's why some people go after risk. So I understand what he's saying, but it really does come back to the successful risk taker, even when they are seeking out those kind of sensations, are the ones who manage it out. They're not, you know, saying, oh, my gosh, I want this rush so much. I'm not going to wear a helmet while I'm doing motocross, or I'm, you know, just going to take off on this very, very dangerous jump without, you know, for the first time without any training. So I think that's the difference. It's step by step. It's working at the edge of your performance ability, and it's measuring out those risks so that you can be successful and still get that rush, but, you know, without losing your head.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Jen in Milton. Jen, hi.
Hi there. I actually have a question in regard to birth order. So I was just wondering, is there a link to the order that you were born and taking risks?
Jen, thanks for that call. Kate, I don't remember if I saw that in your book. Is there some kind of birth order risk index?
Well, you know, there are some studies, and of course they tend to contradict one another, but the sort of common wisdom is that the older siblings tend to be a certain kind of risk taker, and that they plow forward, they blaze new trails, and they tend to be the more successful kind of risk takers. They have to take into account the rules. They're the first child, so often they have a little more scaffolding from their parenting around that they have to work around, et cetera, and they can be very successful. But then a lot of studies also show that the babies of the family, the youngest, they tend to be a little bit more impulsive. So I think that there is some work that suggests that birth order can affect things, but as always, with some of these studies, your mileage may vary. It's going to depend on a lot on the parenting environment, their involvement, what activities they have to work it out. But there probably is a little bit of an effect.
Talking to Kate Sukul about risk. Her new book is called The Art of Risk. Kate, we had a caller who couldn't stay on the line named Alex in Eau Claire, said, hey, I'm quitting my job in Wisconsin, moving to Colorado, nervous, it going wrong, his new plan there. And I wanted to ask you about that failure part of it. You say part of being a good risk taker is knowing how to bounce back and how to learn when you've taken a risk that didn't pay off.
Definitely. So I guess the thing I would say to Alex first and foremost is that it's a risk to stay, too. So if you weren't going to make this change, then you'd always be thinking, what if I had gone to Colorado? And so you might have missed out on something great. But let's just say that it doesn't work out for one reason or another. What can you learn from, and I don't even know that I would call it a failure. One of the best lines that I heard from, and it was from Steph Davis, again, the base jumper, she doesn't fail, she just hasn't finished yet. Maybe, you know, this is all a bigger long-term quest to find out where you need to be, where you belong. And maybe it's not Colorado, but maybe it's not Eau Claire either. And so maybe this is just another piece of information, another step to help you figure out where you should be going, the kind of job that will fulfill you, the kind of place to live that is going to give you what you need.
And when you mentioned there that staying could be a risk too, that reminds me that the idea that we look at the action we could take as a risk, we don't look at not taking that action as something we might miss out on. So I think of, you know, well, my kids do soccer. I'm paranoid about concussions, but I let them play because they get a lot of benefits from it. Keeping mm-hmm. them playing it safe and not letting them do that would mean they're not getting a lot that they are getting now.
Right. And actually, I remember this great line from Still Life with Woodpecker, which I guess is, you know, that perennial college student favorite book. Success can eliminate as many options as failure. So often we look at failure as some kind of sign that, okay, we messed up, we can't do this, this isn't what we're supposed to be going after. And we don't realize that sometimes even when we're successful, we've actually just eliminated a lot of options, options that might have taught us some really important lessons, that might have taken us somewhere where we would have actually gotten more, whether that's a better job or a better, you know, relationship or a more fulfilling life. So again, when you start thinking about risk to and risk from, you really start to realize that every single decision you make every single day has this uncertainty involved in it. And so you need to get used to it. You better get a better handle on it, or else you could be missing stuff out on stuff either way.
As we start to wrap up, Kate, it seems like part of your mission is to convince us that risk is not inherently a negative thing.
It's true. I think, you know, what the science definitely says is that risk is necessary. It's not bad. It's not good. We need to stop talking about it in extremes. It's necessary. You need to risk a little bit in order to learn, in order to gain skills, in order to learn how to emotionally regulate, to problem solve, to work with others. I think we all agree, whether we're talking about kids or adults, these are all really positive things. And so if we continue to talk about risk as something to be avoided at all costs, we're missing the opportunity to really open ourselves up to unbridled possibility. And, you know, I think that would be a darn shame, because that's, I think, what a lot of us need more of, is some unbridled possibility.
And you're glad you took the risk to get married again?
I am. I like him very much. Even now, a couple years later, I think I'll keep him.
Fantastic. Kate, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
We've been talking to Kate Sukel. She is the author of the new book on the science of risk. It's called The Art of Risk, The New Science of Courage, Caution, and Chance. Still not going to go skydiving myself anytime soon, but this is, I don't know, this kind of changes the way you think about risk.
You're going to take some more risks now? Maybe try some, I don't know, I'm thinking about starting small for you, Rob. Try maybe a new restaurant nearby?
We just did.
That's true, we did, but that was unusual.
Chicken tikka wrap. It was pretty tasty, too. Two of them.
It paid off.
Wisconsin played host to the World Cheese Championship this week, and even better, a Wisconsin cheese won the top prize, the first American-made cheese to win in 28 years.
And the winner was a Roth Grand Cru Suchois, a smear-ripened hard cheese from the company Emmy Roth USA. The company's based in Fitchburg, and the winning cheese is made in Monroe. The International Panel of Cheese Experts gave it a score of 98.88. out of 100 for the win.
Another Wisconsin cheese made it into the Sweet 16 finals, the extra-aged Pleasant Ridge Reserve by Uplands Cheese in Dodgeville. Big question, though, what does a Grand Cru Suchois taste like and how to say it exactly? But according to the company's website, it's an Alpine-style cheese with, quote, light floral notes, nutty undertones, a hint of fruitiness, and a mellow finish.
I mean, if I didn't know better, that sounds like a description of wine.
It does, yeah. Well, I wonder if these, like, international cheese judges are, like, those wine connoisseur expert type people.
My big question is, how does one become an international cheese expert? Because that could
practice.
Be my next job.
Oh, yeah. I could get into that.
I'm into that.
All right. And we'll have to go on a tasting junket, too, so we're fully informed radio hosts. Well, Roth Grand Cru Suchois, congratulations on the world championship. This is Central Time.